A quick heads up as we get going. The program is going to be 1 minute and 50 seconds longer than usual today. Inflation hits everything, you know? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 10th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Okay, I'm kidding. The space-time continuum and the strict laws of the public radio clock keep us, sadly, to half an hour. But I'll tell you what, it just kind of feels like we ought to grow 6.2%, you know? Everything else is, certainly price-wise, and how people feel about the biggest jump in the consumer price index in 30 years could have a lot to do with what actually happens with prices in this economy. Marketplace's Andy Euler spent his day talking to people who study inflation for a living to see how they're living.
Carola Binder lives in Haverford, Pennsylvania, with her husband and four young children, ages 1 to 7. Everybody drinks a lot of milk.
We actually buy powdered milk at wholesale. So we buy it like 50 pounds at a time. So we don't have to worry about inflation as much because we just have everything like pre-purchased in bulk.
Binder feels price spikes at the grocery store like everybody else, but she also knows how we got here. She teaches economics at Haverford College, and her research focuses on expectations, inflation, and monetary policy. She says what we're seeing right now is in part economic psychology.
You know, when people see prices rising faster than they're used to, how much will they believe that it is just this temporary supply chain issue? And how much will they think that it's something that's more here to stay? And the more they think that it's here to stay, the more they are going to start behaving in ways that do prolong it.
Inflation's self-fulfilling prophecy. But psychology aside, things are more expensive. Eric Friedman at U.S. Bank Asset Management Group says part of the problem is that firms are all experiencing the same supply chain issues. Consumers are used to being able to choose based on price.
But if vendor one and vendor two are both going through some really significant price increases, then there are no alternatives.
So whether you're buying whole milk or milk powder, the cost is still higher than it was last year, which Jay Hatfield, CEO of Infrastructure Capital Management, says policymakers shouldn't ignore.
It's not just a theoretical economic problem. This is going to be a huge problem during the winter for consumers to be able to afford gasoline, utility bills, and food.
On top of that, he says housing prices are seeing more than 20% inflation year over year, and he doesn't think that that's going to slow down anytime soon. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I direct your attention not to stocks, but to the debt market, bonds, which seem to have woken up today and said, inflation. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. People are quitting their jobs. Perhaps you've heard, whether for opportunity or necessity, they are doing it by the millions. And the problem is especially acute in healthcare. More than 500,000 healthcare workers quit their jobs in August, the highest rate in the past 20 years. And the number of working nurses is down nearly 8% since the pandemic started. From nurses to lab techs to health aides and administrators, people just want something else. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman talked to two nurses who worked through the pandemic at a big public hospital in New York City.
Both nurses are 29, grew up in New York, and have mostly worked at big public safety net hospitals.
My name's Kelly Cabrera. I'm a registered nurse, and I work in the Bronx in an emergency room at Jacoby Medical Center.
Cabrera came to Jacoby's Level 1 Trauma Center just out of nursing school in her early 20s.
When I started here, I was one of the youngest people in the ER, and I was working with nurses that have been doing this for, you know, longer than I've been alive.
She worked hard and learned a lot. Then COVID hit.
We definitely didn't have enough staff. We didn't have enough PPE. We were really overwhelmed.
People started burning out on the job. And now, even though COVID cases have subsided, patients who delayed care during the pandemic are surging into the hospital.
Our ER is busier than it's ever been before. We're seeing so many more patients. Our patients are sicker.
And lots of folks who treat them are leaving.
This week alone, we lost 2 nurses in the ER, almost 10 in the last 2 months.
And a stream of temporary nurses and new hires come in to cover.
Sometimes you come into work and I don't recognize people because so many people have left.
That includes her friend and fellow ER nurse, Clivia Braya, who started at the hospital 3 years ago.
Jacoby was my dream hospital when I graduated nursing school. My family grew up right around Jacoby, and it's a very large immigrant population. That's kind of like what my family was when we were growing up.
It was also her dream job. She earned around $80,000 a year on a union contract, treating everything under the sun. But with the risk of COVID, all that didn't seem so great anymore.
You know, right after the pandemic, it starts to get into your head, okay, well, if I'm going to go through all of this, then maybe I should go make more money.
So she moved to a private hospital nearby. Her salary went up by $20,000. Nurses have an even more lucrative option. They can sign on as traveling nurses to plug staffing gaps around the country. Kelly Cabrera says nurses she's trained at Jacoby have left to make
$7,000 a week.
At the same time, a lot of veteran nurses are leaving and taking institutional knowledge with them.
Those are the people you want teaching you. A lot of those nurses have either retired or they've changed departments. They've gone to something easier because this is just, it's unmanageable.
Meanwhile, Cabrera's friend Clivia Braya found the transition to her new higher-paying nursing job unmanageable. New ER, new protocols, lots of turnover there, too. After 2 months, she realized
the challenges in nursing don't really go away, even if you're being paid more.
And she missed her old hospital.
It was the relationships that I had built that I wanted to go back to the environment where I felt safe. I could go up to one of my residents and have just a conversation like, hey, why are we doing this versus this?
So she's back at Jacoby. And her friend Kelly Cabrera is happy, even though she isn't sure how much longer she can stick it out.
I've been a nurse for 7 years, and probably the last 6 months have been me thinking, like, maybe this is not the right move. Being a nurse is not the right move.
Neither woman wants to leave nursing. They see it as a calling. But they want better pay and more support to get the job done. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Here's a data point for the bibliophiles among you. According to NPD BookScan, which tracks publishing, print book sales were up 18% in the first half of the year. Dealing with that demand, though, which is a good problem to have, I grant you, but it's been tough for publishers and retailers. Marketplace's Savannah Marr takes us a couple of steps up the book supply chain.
Native Realities Press was planning to release some new comic books in time for this year's holiday shopping season. But by late summer, CEO Lee Francis had a realization.
It's just not going to happen. This is the supply chain apocalypse.
Starting with a shortage of the raw material that's used to make paper, wood pulp. Pete Stewart heads up Forest to Market, which keeps an eye on the timber industry.
About a third of the raw material would come from sawmill chips.
In the early days of the pandemic, he says a lot of sawmills downsized or shut down entirely. The companies didn't know how many Americans would spend their extra time and stimulus money.
They decided, well, I'll probably put a new deck on the back of my house. I might expand my office.
The price of lumber and wood pulp spiked. Meanwhile, people were doing a lot of online shopping, which, according to Kristen McLean, an analyst with NPD BookScan, caused paper mills to shift their priorities.
A lot of paper and pulp has been redirected towards things like shipping boxes.
And away from book-grade paper. McLean says this may mean holiday shoppers have fewer choices about where to purchase books.
Bigger retailers are going to probably be prioritized.
She says publishers are likely to fill their largest orders for, say, Barnes & Noble, before sending a few dozen copies to a local indie. And if you have your heart set on shopping local for a particular title, McLean says the time to order is now. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
people put the flower pots out on the street.
I mean, flowers are nice, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here you go. 6.2% inflation year on year. The Dow Industrial's down 240 points today. 0.6%, 36,079. The NASDAQ down 263 points. That is 1.6%, 15,622. The S&P 500 dipped 38.8%. 46 and 46. Look out, electric vehicles. Now, Rivian Automotive surged 29% today in its trading debut, now valued more than General Motors or Ford. Speaking of Ford, it holds a 12% stake in Rivian. Amazon, by the way, has a 20% stake. Rivian is based in Irvine, California. If you Google where is Coinbase based, you will find that Coinbase is, honestly, it's based nowhere. This is what they say. Crypto is about decentralization, I guess. Where people go to buy, sell, and store cryptocurrencies. Shares, anyway, to get to the point, down 8% today after reporting quarterly revenue lower than expected. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up 1.57% a couple of days ago. It was about 1.44, right? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Mitchell was talking a minute ago about people leaving their jobs. Healthcare specifically for Mitchell, yes, but it is happening across the economy. And one of the things a lot of people who are doing that are doing is starting their own businesses. A record number of new businesses, actually, since the pandemic started. The Census Bureau has been keeping an eye on what economists call new business formation informally for years now. Next month, they are making it official. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino explains what's going on there.
If there's one economic indicator everyone knows about, it's probably the unemployment rate, right? It says a whole lot about what's going on in the economy, but the concept hasn't been around forever.
We didn't measure unemployment during the Depression. We still don't know with any precision exactly how many people are unemployed.
Betsy Stevenson is an economist at the University of Michigan. She says until the 1930s, the U.S. government could only guess at unemployment levels and excluded women, which meant it was underestimating how bad things were.
The Depression taught us that unemployment is a problem that we need to know about, that we need to measure and address directly.
What gets measured and how has big implications for the economy. And the fast-moving nature of the pandemic demands new measurements, says Ron Jarman, the director of the Census Bureau.
You know, most of our economic statistics have a frequency that just doesn't give that sort of timely lens into how the pandemic is impacting people in the economy.
The unemployment rate tells us what the economy looked like a month ago, but the measure of startups taken from IRS filings for new business licenses gives a sense of what the economy might look like tomorrow, says economist John Haltewanger at the University of Maryland.
It's like the canary in the mine. It's an early indicator of business activity.
The Census Bureau started releasing this data in 2018 as kind of an experiment. As an official statistic going forward, the report might include data on business location and the race, ethnicity, or gender of startup founders. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We've been talking for going on 2 years now about everything that businesses have had to do to keep going through the pandemic. And really, by now, it's pretty clear that adapting to the coronavirus economy has kind of become the baseline. About 6 months or so ago, I talked to Jess Evans. She's in Austin, Texas. I was asking her about how her then new-ish bar and party trivia game company, Get It Gals is called, was surviving. It was surviving, but it was hard, given that there wasn't much going on back then, bar and party-wise. So the other day, we asked her to send us an update.
Business has been continuously shifting, and we've been doing that big 2021 word that I feel like everyone's talking about all the time. It's the constant pivot. 2020, miraculously, was our biggest year yet. The reason I think for that is that we were able to open up our private games to the virtual world. So not only were we serving the Austin area, we're able to now serve a global market. We have hosted trivia events for folks in South America, Europe. We've done a good handful for India, which has been so cool. And then with bringing back in-person events, we're set up right now, it looks like, for 2021 to be even bigger. I was finally able to actually put 100% of my working focus on just running Get It Gals. It's been pretty wild. I never would have thought that this could be a full-time job, especially because when we first started it, we were doing it for a bar tab and no money. So here we are now. Definitely one of the best parts of getting to do this job full-time is when we are doing a themed trivia, and especially when it's a brand new theme, one that we have never tried out before, writing the questions, because that just means I get to like watch TV or movies. We're going to do a Ted Lasso trivia. So that show already like puts you in the best mood, and I'm watching it and I'm like, I'm working, quote unquote, and it feels real good.
Jess Evans, making trivia in Austin, Texas. A lot of the conversations we're having around housing in this economy right now are about the lack of it. Affordable, houses at the median price point, all along the price spectrum, there just isn't enough of it. Thing is, though, in a lot of cities, there are thousands of houses just sitting empty. For more than a year now, Amy Scott's been telling that story through a single city block in West Baltimore, a block that is changing from mostly vacant buildings into a growing community of homeowners led by a group called Black Women Build. Here's Amy.
It's a quiet morning on Edding Street as Poinsettia McKnight steps out her front door with a broom and shovel and goes to work sweeping the street.
People will throw glass, nails. They don't care.
She's been doing this most mornings for decades, keeping the 1900 block of Edding Street clean. McKnight, or Miss Poinsettia, as everyone around here calls her, is 78 years old. She's retired from the U.S. Customs Service, and she grew up in the brightly painted red brick row house she now owns on what was once a block full of life.
People put the flower pots out on the street with flowers and everything, and to paint the steps. It was really nice.
There's a lot of history on this block in one of Baltimore's oldest black neighborhoods. In the 60s, her parents helped found a drum and bugle corps here that played all over Maryland. Miss Poinsettia was the group's secretary. She says when President Kennedy came to speak at a rally in Baltimore,
our organization furnished the music. And I had a black and white TV then. I didn't know he was a redhead till then.
Over the years, her beloved block declined, a victim of a familiar pattern in redlined neighborhoods. The crack and opioid epidemics and mass incarceration devastated West Baltimore. Subprime lending led to foreclosures, and real estate speculators let houses sit empty. Eventually, the city tore down half the block. Miss Poinsettia and some neighbors got together to paint vacant houses and fence off a troublesome empty lot. But by 2019, she was the last homeowner standing, pleading with city officials to spare her house.
I done seen this block go down, and now I'm seeing it come up.
It's coming up because in the past 2 years, the nonprofit Black Women Build Baltimore has been buying vacant houses, training young Black women to help renovate them, and then selling them to the women at affordable prices. So far, there are 4 new homeowners on the block. Another 3 houses are almost done. And Miss Poinsettia is finally getting some help. Later that same morning, a bunch of volunteers arrive to start clearing a vacant lot at the end of the block for a community garden.
We can start trimming on this side.
Gardener Derek Weston is leading the effort to bring fresh vegetables and flowers to the block. One of the new homeowners, Chanel Austin, trims overgrown branches that have swallowed a fence along one side of the lot. She's pretty comfortable with power tools after helping rebuild her house.
Yeah, it's a perfect place for an urban garden. I'm excited to be a part of it. It's right outside my door.
Guanche Henderson is happy for the company. She was the first to buy a house through Black Women Build. When we first met more than a year ago, she was lonely, waiting anxiously for more neighbors. Now that people are moving in and other developers are building in the area, she's got a different problem.
This is kind of selfish of me, but I realize that all the parking spots are quickly being taken up on this block.
One downside of revitalization. Black Women Build's mission is to build not just houses and wealth, but community. Quanche's been taking a weekly class to learn how to mobilize her neighbors for better conditions.
So one of my ideas is to get us all, like, to figure out how we can get parking permits. So that's one thing. But anything else, I would have to, like, see what people care about.
After a while, the original activist, Miss Poinsettia, comes across the street to watch the new generation.
Yeah, I just got through cleaning up this morning. I wish I could have had y'all this morning.
we'll see if we can help you out moving forward here.
I appreciate that, but it should be beautiful. Okay?
I'm looking forward to it.
A few days later, Black Women Build throws a party to celebrate the progress on the block. The 7 houses with their restored brick facades and white cornices gleam in the sunshine. Potted plants once again line the sidewalk. The city housing commissioner is there, along with state officials and donors. And of course, the group's founder, Shelley Halstead, the carpenter who saw the potential in these houses when the city was about to tear them down.
We have 4 new women homeowners. Their mortgages range from like $400 to $600, right?
That's $400 to $600 a month for a completely refurbished 2-bedroom house. A comparable rental in the area could cost twice that.
This truly makes it affordable, right? If this area gentrifies, we're safe.
There's another reason to celebrate.
Yay! Is this my son's birthday? I just want to say, when I first saw this block and I walked around it and I saw her garden, I swear to God, that is when I was like, I'm going to fight for this block. We have to save it.
And I'm thrilled that you came in because I asked them to save this block. My wish came true.
Shelley's not stopping here. She's still trying to buy a couple of crumbling houses on the block whose owners have been holding out. And she's fighting for other blocks, too. Black Women Build has bought 10 more abandoned houses nearby that are waiting to be saved and filled with more neighbors for Miss Poinsettia. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, offered from the 20,000 square foot office space that is Marketplace World headquarters, which on any given day has 4 people in it. 4. There is some new data out from the Partnership for New York City, a nonprofit whose job is boosting New York City. Anyway, the group says as of late October, just 28% of Manhattan office workers were working in the office on an average weekday. They figure the group does that'll be up to 49% by the end of January. As for these office spaces at the corner of Figueroa and 2nd in downtown Los Angeles, Yeah, I don't know. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. The flip side, I guess, of the coin of those inflation numbers we got today. Also out this morning, first-time claims for unemployment benefits. And yes, I know they usually come out on Thursdays, but tomorrow is a federal holiday, Veterans Day, in case it got away from you. Anyway, 267,000 initial applications last week, pretty much right in the ballpark over your average week in the before times. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Liana Squalache, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.